For if it is not men who are drunk, drugged, or deranged, but men sober, healthy, and writing treatises about truth, standards, and criteria, who, in the very clearest experiences and movements of sense perception, suppose that what does not exist is true, or that what is false and non-existent is the truth, then it is not their suspending judgment about everything that is remarkable, but rather that they assent to anything human at all. Nor is it incredible that they have no settled judgment about appearances, but rather that they hold contrary ones. One would be less surprised at a man who, instead of asserting either of two contrary and opposing claims, suspends judgment about them, than at men who contradict and oppose one another. For the man who neither affirms nor denies, but remains quiet, is at odds with the one who affirms an opinion less than the one who denies it is, and at odds with the one who denies it less than the one who affirms it. And if it is possible to suspend judgment about these matters, then it is not impossible in the case of other matters either, at least on your own premises, since you hold that one sense perception does not differ in the least from another, nor one impression from another. The doctrine of suspension of judgment, then, is not a fable, nor a device for hunting down impudent and reckless young men, as Collotes supposes. It is a settled state and disposition of grown men, one that guards against error and does not surrender judgment to senses so discredited and so at odds with themselves, nor lets itself be deceived along with those who claim that appearances offer proof of what is unclear, even while observing so much unreliability and obscurity in the appearances themselves. But a fable, rather, is the infinite worlds and the images, and it is the man who, writing about Pythocles when he was not yet 18 years old, declares that there is no finer nature in all of Greece, and reports on him in extravagant terms, and who himself feels what women feel, praying that all things connected with the young man's excess be free of envy and reproach. He is the one who breeds recklessness and impudence in the young. Are not those men sophists and charlatans who write so insolently and arrogantly against men of repute? And yet Plato, Aristotle, Theophrastus, and Democritus disputed with those who came before them. But no one else has ventured to publish a book bearing such a title, directed against everyone at once. Hence, like men who have transgressed against the divine and are confessing their own misdeeds, near the very end of the book he says that those who established laws and customs, and who set cities under kingship and government, brought human life into great security and tranquility, and freed it from turmoil. But if anyone abolishes these things, we shall live the life of beasts, and whoever meets another will all but devour him. These are Collotes' very words, and they are neither just nor true. For if one were to abolish the laws, but leave in place the doctrines of Parmenides, Socrates, Heraclitus, and Plato, we should be very far from devouring one another and living the life of beasts. For we would fear disgraceful acts and honor justice for its own nobility, believing that we have good gods as our rulers and divine spirits as guardians of our life, and holding that not even all the gold above and beneath the earth is worth as much as virtue. Doing willingly, for reason's sake, as Xenocrates says, what men now do only unwillingly, for fear of the law. When then will our life become bestial, savage, and unsociable? When the laws are abolished, but the doctrines urging us toward pleasure remain, the providence of the gods is no longer believed in, and men consider wise those who spit upon nobility, if pleasure is not attached to it, mocking and laughing at the sayings. There is an eye of justice that sees all things, and the God stands near and watches close at hand. And God, as the old saying has it, holding the beginning and middle and end of all things, accomplishes his straight course as he travels round according to nature. And justice follows him, as avenger of those who fall short of the divine law. For those who despise these sayings as mere fables, and who locate the good in the belly and the other channels through which pleasure arrives, need law and fear, and the lash, and some king or ruler holding justice in his hand, so that they may not devour their neighbors once their gluttony is emboldened by atheism. For indeed the life of beasts is of just this sort. They know nothing better than pleasure, they know no justice of the gods, nor do they revere nobility, but whatever boldness, cunning, or energy nature has given them, they employ toward the pleasure of the flesh and the satisfaction of appetite, just as the wise Metrodorus thinks proper, when he says that all the fine, wise, and extraordinary discoveries of the soul exist for the sake of the pleasure of the flesh and the hope of that pleasure. And that every accomplishment which does not tend toward this end is empty. If the laws were abolished by these reasonings and philosophical doctrines, nothing would be lacking to us but wolves' claws, lions' teeth, the bellies of oxen, and the throats of camels. And these same passions and doctrines, for lack of words and writing, beasts express in roars and whinnies and other such sounds, and every sound they utter is a sound of the belly, welcoming and fawning upon the pleasure of the flesh, present or expected, unless some creature is by nature simply fond of noise and chatter. No praise, then, could be worthy enough for those who established laws, constitutions, offices, and legal codes against these bestial passions. But who are the ones confounding, overthrowing, and utterly abolishing these things? Is it not those who withdraw themselves and their associates from political life? Is it not those who say that the crown of tranquility is beyond comparison with great empires? Is it not those who declare kingship a sin and a downfall, and who write in these very words that one ought to explain how a man may best preserve the end set by nature, and how he may, of his own will, never in the first place approach positions of authority over the masses? And further, in addition to these words, there is no more need to save the Greeks, or to win from them a crown for wisdom, but rather to eat and drink, Timocrates, in a way that is harmless and pleasing to the flesh. And yet, in the very ordering of laws that Colotes himself praises, belief concerning the gods is the first and greatest element. And Lycurgus consecrated the Spartans, Numa the Romans, Ion of old the Athenians, and Deucalion virtually all the Greeks together, making them susceptible to the divine, through prayers, oaths, oracles, and reports, by means of hopes and fears at once. Traveling about, you might find cities without walls, without writing, without kings, without houses, without wealth, having no need of currency, unacquainted with theaters and gymnasiums. But a city without temples and without gods, one that makes no use of prayers, oaths, divinations, or sacrifices either for the sake of blessings or for the warding off of evils, no one has ever seen, nor will ever see. Rather, it seems to me, a city could sooner come into being without ground beneath it than a political community could either be formed, or having been formed, be preserved, once belief concerning the gods had been entirely removed. This, then, the very support and foundation holding together every human community and system of law, they overturn, not by circling around it, nor secretly and through riddles, but by attacking it directly, as the first of the most authoritative beliefs. Then, as though driven by some avenging punishment, they confess to doing terrible things, throwing customs into confusion and abolishing the ordinances of the laws, so that they may not even obtain pardon. For to err in one's opinion, even if it is not the mark of wise men, is nonetheless human. But how could one describe the act of accusing others of the very things one does oneself, if one is sparing of the names such conduct deserves? For if, writing against Antidorus or Bion the Sophist, he had made mention of laws, political community, and constitutional order, would not someone have said to him, "You, poor wretch, quietly wrapping your little bit of flesh in your own bedclothes, let those who have lived their lives in household and civic responsibility bring charges against me on these matters." And these are all men whom Colotes has reviled. Among them, Democritus advises that men be taught the political art, since it is the greatest of all, and that they pursue the labors from which great and splendid things come to human beings. Parmenides ordered his own homeland with excellent laws, so that the magistrates, every year, put the citizens under oath to abide by the laws of Parmenides. Empedocles, after exposing the leading citizens who were behaving arrogantly and plundering the public funds, drove them out, and he freed his country from barrenness and plague by walling off the clefts of a mountain, through which the south wind used to pour down upon the plain. Socrates, after his condemnation, when his friends had contrived an escape for him, did not make use of it, so as to uphold the laws, but chose to die unjustly rather than be saved unlawfully. Melesus, serving as general of his homeland, defeated the Athenians in a naval battle. Plato left behind beautiful writings on laws and political constitution, but he instilled far better ones in his companions, through whom Sicily was liberated by Dion, and Thrace by Pytho and Heracles, who killed Cotys, And from the academy came forth Athenian generals such as Chabrias and Phocion. Epicurus, by contrast, sent men to Asia to revile Timocrates and to drive the man out of the royal court, because, though his brother, he had fallen out with Metrodorus, and this is written in their own books. Plato, on the other hand, sent out his companions, Aristonomus to the Arcadians, to set their constitution in order, Phormio to the Eleans, and Menedemus to the Pyrrheans. Eudoxus, who had been Plato's associate, wrote laws for the Cnidians, and Aristotle for the people of Stagira. And Alexander asked Xenocrates for advice concerning kingship. And the man sent to Alexander by the Greeks settled in Asia, who did the most to kindle and spur him to undertake the war against the barbarians, was Delius of Ephesus, a companion of Plato. As for Zeno, the disciple of Parmenides, who attacked the tyrant Demilus and met with misfortune in the attempt, he proved the doctrine of Parmenides in the fire to be like gold, unadulterated and genuine, and demonstrated by his deeds that disgrace, not pain, is what a great man fears, pain being feared by children, and by women, and by men who have the souls of women. For he bit through his own tongue and spat it at the tyrant. But from the words and doctrines of Epicurus, I will not even ask who among them became a tyrannicide, or a champion in war, or a lawgiver, or a ruler, or a king's counselor, or a leader of the people, or a man tortured or put to death on behalf of justice. But which of your sages ever sailed on his country's behalf, went on an embassy, or spent his own money for it? Where is any political act of yours recorded? And yet the fact that Metrodorus went down to the Piraeus, 40 stads, to help a certain Mithers, a Syrian in the king's service who had been arrested, was written up and sent to everyone, in every letter, with Epicurus boasting grandly and solemnizing that little journey. What, then, would they have said, had they accomplished something like what Aristotle did, refounding his native city after it had been destroyed by Philip? Or what Theophrastus did, freeing his city from tyranny twice over? Would not the Nile have sooner run out of papyrus to carry than these men have wearied of writing about themselves? And the outrage is not merely that, among so many philosophers, they are almost the only ones who share in the goods of their cities while contributing nothing, but that even writers of tragedy and comedy always try to offer something useful and to speak on behalf of laws and civic order. Whereas these men, even when they do write, write about politics so that we will not engage in politics, and about rhetoric so that we will not practice oratory, and about kingship so that we will avoid living alongside kings. And they name statesmen only to mock them and tear down their reputations, saying of Epaminondas that he had some good in him, and even that, a small one, phrasing it in just those words, calling him a man of iron guts, and asking what possessed him to march through the middle of the Peloponnese instead of sitting at home in his little cap, devoted, no doubt, entirely to the care of his belly, as they are. And what Metrodorus, dancing his contempt for political life, wrote in his book on philosophy, I did not think I should leave out. He says, some of the wise, out of a great abundance of vanity, understood the business of political philosophy so well that they go rushing off toward the very same ambitions as Lycurgus and Solon in their discourses about ways of life and virtue. So it was vanity, and a great abundance of vanity, that Athens should be free, that Sparta should be well governed by law, that the young should not grow insolent, that children should not be fathered on courtesans, and that wealth, luxury, and licentiousness should not rule, but rather law and justice in the cities, for these were the ambitions of Solon. And Metrodorus, heaping abuse, adds to what he has said. Therefore it is right for the truly free man to laugh a hearty laugh, both at the rest of mankind and at these Lycurguses and Solons. But this man, Metrodorus, is not free at all. He is servile and ill-bred, and deserves not even the whip fit for a free man, but that studded scourge with which they punish the galley when they offend, in the temples of the mother goddess. That it was not against lawgivers but against the laws themselves that they were waging war, one may hear from Epicurus himself. For he asks himself, in his perplexities, whether the wise man will do any of the things the laws forbid if he knows he will escape detection, and he answers, the simple predicate does not admit an easy answer, that is to say, I will do it, but I am unwilling to admit it. And again, I believe, writing to Idomeneus, he urges him, not to live in servitude to laws and opinions, so long as they do not, through the trouble caused by one's neighbor, bring on the annoyance that comes from being struck. If then, those who abolish laws and civic constitutions thereby abolish human life itself, and Epicurus and Metrodorus do just this, turning their companions away from taking part in public affairs, showing hostility to those who do take part, speaking ill of the first and wisest of lawgivers, and urging men to despise the laws unless the fear of a beating and punishment is attached to them. Then, I do not know what falsehood of such magnitude Colotes has told against others. Comparable to the truth he has himself, unwittingly, laid as a charge against the words and doctrines of Epicurus.